Firstly, I would like to thank Mr. Dollar for extending an invitation to me to speak to you. It's my pleasure to talk about sulphur. As you've just gathered, I've spent my entire life talking about sulphur in one way or another and doing things with sulphur. I have a confession to make, though. As you know, I come from the UK. I've only lived in Western Canada since 1980. There are people in this room who predate me by some years, both in terms of actual age and also in terms of their knowledge in the sulphur industry. So please don't view what I'm going to say as a historically accurate presentation. But nevertheless, what I would like to do over the next 20 minutes or so is to try to tell you a little about the science history of sulphur, a little bit about the development within Alberta, and I'm going to venture beyond history into the future and talk about how expertise that's been built up in Western Canada since about 1950 is now recognised worldwide, and I'll give you some examples of that. So here's a nice block of sulphur. This is in fact one from the Shell Shunt facility, and if you deal with oil and gas, you're going to be dealing with sulphur, and I'll explain to you why that's the case in terms of the science history, and then we'll move on to talk about some other things as well. So, many of you have seen these blocks of sulphur around the province. At one time, we had close to 28 million tonnes in storage. It went down to almost zero, then came back up to about 16 million tonnes, and now because of extra demand, that stockpile is going down once again in most locations. So you can still see nitrogen in these blocks, although these ones just about disappeared now. Not much left of these, they've gone onto the export market. Okay, well, here's the science history of sulphur. This is a picture of the galaxy Andromeda, and I'm showing this because, of course, within that galaxy there are millions and millions of stars. And in each star, nuclear fusion processes are occurring, and we're producing in those nuclear fusion processes all of the elements, including sulfur. And when very large suns go through a relatively short lifespan, they contract and there is a stellar explosion, and the material is dispersed across the universe. And that material reaggregates in planetary systems around new suns. And the planetary system, of course, that we're interested in contains this planet, planet Earth, very special in many ways, has just the right ingredients to produce all of the things that we see around us. And in particular, of course, carbon and sulfur are key elements. Everything we touch at lunch, everything we eat is originated in a stellar process, which is a sulfuring source. The carbon we've just consumed with all the other bits and pieces, also the sulfur, which are present in the amino acids and the proteins, everything came our way from the stellar event. And all of this, nuclear chemistry and physics, took place over about 13 billion years, we think. We don't really know for sure. So I'm telling you these things and just verbatim to what physicists tell me, but whether it's true or not, who knows. So anyway, planet Earth is a special place, and it has lots of sulfur chemistry to keep something like myself in it. Okay, well, as a chemist, I have to show you at least part of the periodic table. And I hope you can all read this at the back there. Hydrogen, of course, a very important element. But over on what we call the P-block elements, you see carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and then below oxygen is sulfur. And sulfur, if I may now give you a very, very small chemistry lesson, is exactly like oxygen in terms of its chemical properties. And we know you can oxidize carbon with oxygen to make carbon dioxide. Well, sulfur is also capable of oxidizing carbon. And geologically, the chemistry of this is interesting, and I'll show you that chemistry in a moment or two. The first fact is an interesting one. Sulfur is within the Earth's crust, we think, is about twice as abundant as carbon. and we know there's a heck of a lot of carbon. Most of that sulfur is dissolved as sodium sulfate within the world's oceans. But there, of course, are metal sulfides of the type that we mine in Western Canada, copper sulfides. There are iron sulfides, molybdenum sulfides. I could go on and on. But there is a heck of a lot of carbon. Sulfur is very important for our metabolism. It's controlling energy transfer processes within our bodies. And so when I move my arm, I'm actually hydrolyzing the carbon sulfur bond, and that energy is cascading through a variety of biochemical processes. It is one of the driving systems, and those systems depend on chemical energetics, which would be a very, very long discussion, and I won't dwell on that one. But the sulfur industry, though, we turn sulfur that we export into sulfuric acid, and that makes fertilizer. And of course, fertilizer is driving large parts of our economy. The last factor, though, is the one which I will just give you a very brief chemistry lesson on, and that is that carbon is linked to sulfur by what we term the carbon and the sulfur cycles actually interact in nature. And wherever we find stored carbon, we are very, very likely to find sulfur, either as hydrogen sulfide or as something else. And so when we utilize oil and gas, ultimately, we're going to produce sulfur. And so, in Alberta, we've been blessed with very large hydrocarbon deposits. And so, therefore, we have to deal with sulfur in all of its forms. Let me just show you the chemistry here. Geologically, what has happened is that sulfides, which exist in all kinds of deposits, became oxidized by the oxygen in the atmosphere, which arises through photosynthesis. So when plants exhale, they give out oxygen. That oxygen has converted sulfides, which are represented by the MSX terminology in my figure, they've been oxidized to sulfates. And we believe that oil and gas have accumulated by organic material at the bottom of very large areas of water, for instance, the Western Sedimentary Basin, was in fact a giant sea which stretched from the Rockies through to Manitoba. As those seas evaporated, then the oil and gas forming materials were buried, but they were buried with calcium sulfate. And I apologize if this is difficult to read, but here comes the important part. Sulfur, when it's linked to oxygen in that way, is a very powerful oxidant. And slowly but surely, it reacts with the methane, or any other hydrocarbon in the reservoir for that matter. And the net result is, in the case of a simple gas reservoir, methane becomes partly oxidized, and the resulting product is hydrogen sulfide. So when we drill into the reservoirs in the foothills, then we find methane in mixture with hydrogen sulfide and also carbon dioxide, which you can see on that diagram. So that is the classic sour gas mixture, methane, H2S and CO2. Shell had the misfortune to drill into a reservoir, the Bearberry Reservoir, back I think in the mid-1960s, where there was so much calcium sulfate in the reservoir that it had consumed essentially all of the methane. And when we analyzed the gases in our laboratories, in the mid-1960s, we found that there was 91% H2S. Nobody believed what we were telling them. Obviously, the sample was wrong, and we'd done the analysis wrong, but in fact, it was true. The Bearberry Reservoir contains about 150 million tons of hydrogen sulfide with very little methane. You can point to other gas reservoirs. Panther River contains about 70% H2S. There are a whole slew of what we call super sour gas reservoirs, all of which remain undeveloped at this point, but they contain stupendous amounts of H2S. Okay. Don't tell your neighbours that you're living on a sea of H2S. But it's true. Where I live, just northwest of Calgary, there is a reservoir which has so far remained undeveloped, which is about 55% H2S. So, there is a lot of this, but this is all a function of the geochemistry the fact that sulfate, once oxidized, is a powerful oxidant for hydrocarbons. That's the chemistry lesson. Okay, well, many of you know the facts about the petroleum industry, but very briefly, let's go through what's in Alberta. We'll come back to some of these later, but in the dotted rectangle, which lies along the foothills, this is where we find most of the sour gas which I just described. But if we, as you well know, move eastwards and northeastwards, we find lots of oil reservoirs of varying qualities, until we move into the oil sands, the Cretaceous oil sands in northern Alberta, which contain probably 1 to 1.5 trillion barrels of oil, of which we think maybe 300 billion is recoverable, so there is plenty of scope for new technology to help us get to the other 700 million. There is also a green dotted triangle you can see, which is overlapping the Grosmont platform, extending almost all the way down to Edmonton. That contains heavy oil within carbonates, and it's not absolutely sure how much heavy oil is within that formation. It may be as much and again perhaps more than already in the oil sands. So there is a stupendous amount of hydrocarbons. The bottom two-thirds of Alberta is underlain by subacute material. Essentially, the doom and gloom, the naysayers of the hydrocarbon industry say we're going to run out sometime. In my view, this isn't possible. Civilization probably won't last that long. There is plenty to go here, and we can keep warm, certainly using our hydrocarbons. I'll come back to the comments on that about 50,000 tons of sulfur a little later. Okay, so let's very briefly go through the history of sulfur development in Alberta. As we know, one of the original oil fields just south of Calgary, Turner Valley, produced medium quality crude oil. There was associated gas which contained much of H2S. And if you go down to that site and look around, which I did in the early 1980s when I first came to Alberta, there was lots of evidence for sulfur laying around. And most of the H2S from the Turner Valley development was flared. As you can imagine, in the 1920s, that gas wasn't even recovered. The oil was a product which was of interest. But that was really our first, sulfur technology. We simply flared the off gases from oil production. In the 1950s, we began to discover the sour natural gas reserves in the foothills regions, the Tunnett reservoirs that I've been talking about. And that's been the mainstay of our natural gas industry since that time. And many companies were involved in these developments. The 1960s to the 1980 era saw the construction of what I termed synthesized sour gas processing plants. These plants, besides producing lots of methane, produce anywhere from 500 to 6,000 tons of sulfur per day, which, when you compare it to other facilities around the world, is fantastically large. So the development of this type of processing was really a first in Alberta, following only on developments in southwest France in the Lac reservoir, where they had sulfur plants which could produce 2,000 tons a day. So all of the big developments of sour gas processing initially occurred in Western Canada. And of course, this stimulated then a lot of needs around the industry to supply the necessary engineering, the backup information, the chemistry, so on and so forth. So the development of these sulfur plants was really a world first. Much of the engineering was first tried out in Alberta. We got to the point where, of course, we were producing approximately 7 million tons of sulfur per year. This is a reasonably large quantity, as you can see. That accounted for about 40% of the world's export market for elemental sulfur. There are many sources of sulfur in all kinds of forms around the world, but in that period, and to some extent still so today, Alberta had the dominating economic position in export of sulfur around the world. As I mentioned, there's super sour gas, which we usually term as a gas reserve with greater than 50%. There is one gas field just north of Alberta, north of Caroline, Alberta, which is producing about 55% H2S. which now feeds into the Caroline plant operated by Shell. But there are, I could tell you, and I should not tell you where they are, but we have some privileged information through the kind of gas samples that get brought into our laboratory, that all along that foothills region are gas reserves in this range of 50 to 90% H2S. And people, when they discover this gas, there's simply too much sulfur for it to be economic at the present time. And so those gas reserves remain undeveloped. Interestingly, those wells flow at tremendous velocity. So there is a large amount of methane, but the problem is you have to now deal with one well may produce 1,000 tons of sulfur a day. So most people say, okay, we're just going to let that stuff sit there for a while. This period, 1975 to 2010, I've mentioned the Cretaceous oil sands. This will be our next avalanche of sulfur, and I will come back to the scale of that in the future. From 1975 onwards, perhaps a little earlier, Alberta was exporting its knowledge, expertise, its people, and assisting developments of oil and gas around the world where high H2S content gas was discovered. So what I've got now are some nice and historic pictures. This is the, apologize for those at the back, hopefully you can see it. I'm going to give this presentation to Mickey, and you can put it on your website. You're more than welcome to look at the pictures in more clarity on your computer. This is the Pincher Creek plant. You can see blocks of sulfur beginning to develop as people were wondering what to do with this stuff. Wonderful places to work with tremendous scenery. This is the Wildcat Hills plant just west of Calgary, formerly operated by Canadian Sema, now Petro-Canada. Down here you can see the Bow River, so this is just west of Cochrane, Wildcat. I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, have driven by. Here's a pipeline that's taking liquid sulfur across the Bow River, and they were blocking the sulfur on the other side because the rail line was on the other side. So what they could move directly went into the rail, but there was excess sulfur, of course, and those blocks started to appear. All of those blocks have gone, the pipeline across the river has gone, and blocking at Wildcat Hills is no longer in, has been, not been practiced for many years now. This was more or less shut down, I believe, in the mid to late 1980s. So that's the Wildcat Hills plant. And it would produce at its heyday perhaps around 400 tons of sulfur per day. They're now producing around 200 tons per day at Wildcat. It's a relatively small facility. Here is the Petrogas Balzac plant just north of the airport. The twin stacks, I'm sure you've all seen, and piles of sulfur. Sometimes when you take off, always if you're taking off to the north, being the sulfur fanatic, I always make sure if the wind's coming from the north, I get a seat on the right hand side of the plane so I can take a look at the sulfur pile. And there you can see it again, those are going down, but that is receiving gas from reservoirs all along the east side of Calgary. And some of that gas is extremely high H2S, so we have lines which are feeding into the Balzac plant, which have been flowing gas with about 45% hydrogen sulfide. One breath at 1,000 parts per million will kill you. So you can imagine the finesse now which we've developed to enable to handle sour gas in obviously what is a large accommodation. This is the Shell Waterman plant, again another marvellous place to work. Lots of sulfur blocks in the past, again they are disappearing on flats and things disappear on the rail. Just about gone. Who knows, they may come back again, but again an example of something, when I take visitors to see these plants from overseas, you know, we're operating 20, 40 ton a day sulfur plants, and we're operating 2,000, 3,000, 6,000 ton a day sulfur plants. They are staggered by the scale of the equipment. Okay, well, let's talk about the business side of things, business and research. So I want to show you very briefly a few of the historical figures in the sulfur industry. I apologize, obviously, for not covering everything, and I'm looking at it from my perspective. First of all, Jim Hines. In 1964, Jim came from Scotland, by way of Scotland, and through his education at the Kent University of Calgary. which was at that part time still part of the University of Alberta. Jim's an entrepreneur, as many of you know. He decided it would be great to develop research at the University of Calgary in association with the sour gas industry, so that's what he did. So, Alberta Salt Research Limited, the company I work with now, was formed in 1964, and Jim talked with people downtown, got some money together, got the whole group going, and I'll show you how that company is developed. So, Jim was one of the true entrepreneurs in sulfur technology, particularly on the research and development side. So, in the non-commercial sphere, but nevertheless providing vital information to the sulfur industry. Another person you may have seen around town, Joe Lukacs.
No.
Joe started Western Research and Development. Joe is an emigre from Hungary, and his particular interest came from his work originally at the Wildcat Hills plant, which I showed you. He said, okay, we need to do something about some of these emissions, and so he, with a group of friends, started Western Research and Development. And the particular emphasis there was to look at how to control emissions, how to measure emissions, first of all, because in 1965, we really didn't have a lot of expertise. We were still flaring huge amounts of gas, lots of SO2. Before we could control it, we needed to know how much. So Western Research's original mandate was to look at measurement profiles, and also to look at how to control sulfur plants. What I mean by that is analytical monitoring of what was going on in the process, feeding that information back to the front end of the plant in order to make it run better. And Western Research's experience developed over the years to do that type of technology. Here's an example of a Western Research worker, Jackie Hudson. In order to take measurements, you have to climb up those stacks. Something you'd never get me to do. If there's something needs to be done on a ladder, I send my wife up the ladder. So you'd never get me up that stack. I might have to be more than willing to just to do it as well. She would be a stack climber. Jackie Hudson was a stack climber for Western Research and Development. They were taking samples from the top of those stacks, at the bottom of which is an incinerator. So that's quite a job. Can you imagine climbing up to the top of those things during the Chinook? And apparently, according to people who did this, you can feel the thing moving. And the right initiation, apparently, was not to stand there, but to stand on the very rim and walk around it. I know people who did that. This was the right initiation of Western Research. So, stack climbing, emissions control, understanding all of this technology and analytical chemistry was built at Western Research and Development here in Calgary. Let me just go back to before I move on to talk about sulfur and this, but if you go across and overseas, you'll find that everybody knows about Western Research and Development. Although that company is long since gone, there have been a whole host of other companies that really came out of the demise of Western Research, and you can find all of their former employees running other companies and doing these kind of stack measurements across the Welsh. And Canada spawned the two most important companies for measuring emissions from sulfur plants. So very important technology development. Well, if you make 6 to 8 million tonnes a year, sulfur now, if you include the octane, close to 10 million tonnes a year, you need an important distribution system and infrastructure to move all of that sulfur. And Sulfran Limited was formed in approximately 1975 when things were being put together, because it was realised that the industry needed a concerted effort. So Sulfran was formed with the idea, of course, Sulfran means sulfur transportation. So that company was formed in order to put together all of the infrastructure needed to move 6 million tonnes plus of sulfur from Alberta and northeast British Columbia to Vancouver so that we could export that sulfur throughout the world. Ken Doyle was the first president of ASRL, who helped form the company. Ken is now since retired. His expertise was in logistics and moving materials in general, and came from Falcon Ridge in Ontario, although he was originally born in Alberta, and developed Soltrans as the salt distribution company. And here I'm sure you've seen this again, you'll be able to see it much better when if you log on and look at this slide. Here's a train of sulfur cars, which in itself looks simple enough. You just throw sulfur in a car and you take it out to the company and sell it. Well, sulfur is a tricky beast, and there's a lot of technology in those cars. It may not look that way, but there's special linings. The sulfur is pelletized in a special way in order to minimize dust formation. There is essentially no problem with transporting sulfur in this way. When it gets to Vancouver, it's very easy to handle because it's in pelletized form. There is an enormous amount of technology that's gone behind that. And again, I have now mentioned Enersol, who produced one of the technologies for granulation of sulfur. Most of that technology was developed here in Calgary and tried out within the province of Alberta. Of course, there are other pelletization technologies. But again, when you go across the world and look at large sulfur plants now being developed, you can find Enersol technology for pelletization of sulfur. But this transportation is more complex than it might first seem. This is a schematic of Pacific Coast Terminal, where the sulfur then is loaded into ships and it's taken throughout the world. This is an actual photograph. Again, I hope you can see this. Nice reticulated piles of sulfur, where sulfur comes in on a train, it's transferred to the stockpile, and there are stack reclaimers where the sulfur is scraped away and onto a conveyor belt and loaded directly into a ship. And a ship may take as much as 60,000 tons of sulfur in one lot. And that's going, now we export nearly 4 million tons per year to China. Sulfur goes to South Africa, goes to North Africa in the past. Any place where fertilizer is made, where that particular country either does not produce enough sulfur or doesn't have any sulfur at all, then we've exported sulfur through these distribution networks. And again, the development of Soltrans by the sulfur industry has been a key business accomplishment, and again one which the rest of the world looks to when it needs to build new sulfur facilities. Okay, so let's just recap some of the firsts in Alberta. I'll bring in one or two new areas that I haven't talked about. Large-scale sour gas production. And I'm including in here now the hydrogen sulfide, which comes from the hydrotreaters and the heavy oil upgraders and the bitumen upgraders. We're getting very close to 10 million tons a year of H2S, which of course is converted to sulfur. I mentioned the emissions monitoring and pollution control. All of this work was developed at Western Research and Development here in Calgary. Alberta's industry is regulated to minimize SO2 emissions. This has formed what we call very high efficiency tail gas processing for making sure we don't get too much SO2 into the atmosphere. Nearly all of the world's major technologies have first been tested out in the sour gas plants in this province. I mentioned pelletization and distribution. This is a complex process, first done on a very large scale here. Introduction of large-scale liquid sulfur degassing. I haven't talked about that, but we export liquid sulfur to the USA. We're handling liquid sulfur contained in residual H2S that make nasty odors, potentially also very dangerous. And again, degassing technologies were first introduced by Alberta industry. And this part of the industry is not regulated because we were preemptive as an industry as a whole to make sure that we got on top of those kinds of problems. So I think that people are always a little amazed when I tell them, well, we have no regulations, no government regulations for H2S and liquid salt in Alberta. But it's because the industry has done a very, very good job. And we also had the first large-scale solid sulfur storage, as I said, over 25 million tons at one point. An area which I've not yet mentioned is that we go through periods where we have way too much sulfur. and these come and go. And so technology for re-injection of H2S into these lipid reservoirs has been developed. And in fact, throughout the province, there is a total of about 1.3 million tonnes per year of H2S going back underground into depleted reservoirs. And there is about double the amount of carbon dioxide going along with that H2S. And nearly all of the world's re-injection facilities have really arisen in Alberta. And now it's, let me not say a proven technology, because we do it. Even though that 1.3 million sounds like a big number, each individual plant is quite small. But now there are plants which have been constructed, particularly in Kazakhstan, where they plan to re-inject even much larger volumes of H2S. But this technology was first proven here in Alberta. And the last point, sometimes when I'm traveling around, I hear the expression that wherever you find oil, you find Americans. I think it's true that wherever you find sulfur, you find Canadians. Because many of the important developments overseas are receiving help from Canadian companies, Canadian expertise, and I can point to a few examples in a minute of it. Okay, so let's just throw back to this diagram, this map. I've got down here on the bottom left-hand corner, as oil sands production, as bitumen production ramps up to perhaps as much as 5 million barrels per day, we can produce as much as 50,000 tonnes per day of elemental sulfur. That is the equivalent of building probably 20 new major sour gas facilities. So this is our future. Sulfur is not going away, and we will have to continue to deal with it in many respects in Alberta, which may include long-term sulfur repositories. I say may, because prediction of the sulfur market is worse than predicting the weather. Okay, so, but this will be a very large amount. At 5 million barrels per day, we will produce 50,000 tonnes a day of new sulfur. If we upgrade oil in the USA, if we ship bitumen directly to the USA, some of that sulfur will be made in the States. But nevertheless, within North America, over perhaps the next 20 or so years, as these developments proceed, then we can expect to produce another 50,000 tonnes per day, which is, as I said, an equivalent to 20 new major sour gas plants at the time that I've been showing you this afternoon. What's it used for? Well, I mentioned fertilizer. Essentially, lots of uses. It used to be said that a nation's worth could be measured by the amount of sulfur it consumed. That's not exactly true anymore, but nevertheless, it's still a vital component of all industry. And if we were to take sulfur out of the picture, everything would grind to a halt. Refining processes rely on sulfuric acid, which of course is made from sulfur. So sulfur is a key element in the industry. The difficulty for our industry has been to be able to manage it in terms of periods of excess and periods of excess demand, which we're now seemingly slipping into. So it's a very important element, not just from the fertilizer viewpoint, but also from many industrial practices. Well, I've got a map here again at the back of the room. I'm not sure how well you can see all of that, but this area encompasses the Middle East and also northwards into the Caspian, which is some of the states of the former Soviet Union. And I just want to say a little bit about some of these developments here, because they will impact industry in Alberta, because they too could produce over 50,000 tonnes a day of sulfur. If you go to Saudi Arabia, you find very large sour gas developments, which they are now working out how to produce, and they will produce very large volumes. So Saudi Arabia, the sour gas is found in this region here mostly. United Arab Emirates, I'm sure you can't read that, but everybody now knows about Dubai and Abu Dhabi, developing very quickly. They have enormous sour gas reserves, and they are actively pursuing developments in Abu Dhabi, which will make 20,000 tons of sulfur per day in one single project. But of course, they're really after the methane, but they've got to deal with the H2S just like we are. The tiny state of Qatar here, the north end of Qatar overlays the world's largest known natural gas reservoir. And that reservoir contains 2% hydrogen sulfide, which by our scale is very, very little. And yet, this field is absolutely gigantic. They are now selling gas through pipeline systems into many parts of the Middle East. And they are building sulfur terminals very similar to the type that we have at Vancouver, which will have, in the initial phase, an export capacity of 12,000 tons a day. That's a very large amount of sulfur. And when that comes to pass, which it will, then you'll see export developments which impact sulfur. It's interesting to visit Doha, the capital of Qatar. They are building downtown Calgary in one go. So you see 60 or 70 high-rise buildings being built simultaneously. It's quite unbelievable, and it's all driven on the gas wealth. And we can blame a Canadian for helping them do it, since one of the general managing engineers there is a Canadian who's helping to develop the sulfur plant. So Qatar is producing already a large amount of sulfur. There are refineries going up in Kuwait, which will produce another 4,000 tonne a day. If we now skip over the Caspian, we come to the former states of Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, and indeed Russia itself. Turkmenistan is blessed with very little H2S in its gas, but Kazakhstan is already a major producer of sulfur, and they have lots of sulfur, very similar to the ones that we have here, and they have about 9 million tons in storage, and they too are looking to be able to export it. When the Soviet Union collapsed, a Calgarian by the name of Ken Goddard, who worked for Chevron, went over to become the first general director of Tengiz Chevroil, and he helped to improve oil production and at the same time reduce more H2S. And so Canadian technology has been key to the development in Kazakhstan. And they also have, in the north of the Caspian, another field which remains as yet untapped, although it's under development, the Kashagan oil field. 30% H2S in the associated gas, and it's unclear exactly what technology will be used, but we can envisage many, many tons of sulfur coming out of Kazakhstan. Russia too, you can't quite see it, but further north there are giant sour gas fields around Orenburg, and already Russia is producing a lot of sulfur. All of this stuff could be dwarfed by sulfur from the Alberta oil sands, because I said, okay, we can produce 5 million barrels a day. Well, it's just, that's not an absolute limit. That's going to be dependent on the amount of capital investment, infrastructure, and I guess rate at which we want to produce as well, decisions which are still, being thought about. 5 million barrels a day of synthetic crude oil from bitumen is a very large number, but it's actually not a limiting number. If we were to produce 10 million barrels a day, which would be roughly equivalent to the oil production in Saudi Arabia, it's more than possible. But we would then be producing much, much more sulfur. Lastly, I just want to talk a little bit about our own research organization. As I said, ASRL was started at the University of Calgary in 1964 by Jim Hine. I've been involved with this company since 1981. This is a list of our member companies, and if you read through that list, what you'll see is that sulfur is now a multinational business. So one of our member companies, Shell, Chevron, you name it, they've dragged us into projects which they got involved in overseas. And so we've now become a multinational organization. And so we are providing R&D to the world sulfur industry as well as to local industries. And this is very typical of what's happened as we've matured from the early 1950s now to this century, in terms of the knowledge that we picked up in sulfur technology, sulfur engineering in general. So this is homegrown technology, and it's now sought after worldwide through all kinds of organizations. This is my last slide. Somebody asked me when I came in and said, well, we should write a history about sulfur. Western Research and Development asked Fred Simpson to compile a book from which I've taken some of the photographs, so I would like to acknowledge use of those photographs from Fred's book of some of those gas plants. The last step, entrepreneurism and the environment. This talks about the development of Western research and development here in Calgary, and some of the issue of emissions. Many, many new chapters are that came out of this original effort. So with that last slide, I will thank you for your kind attention and your invitation to come speak with me. Thanks very much.